documenting the crisis of our republic, waging war on the new world order. This is Govern America. Govern America.
From just south of the Great Lakes capital city, covering all of North America via satellite, micro-FM stations all across the country, and streaming live from FEMA Region 5 in Michigan, planning Region 2, this is Govern America. I'm Darren Weeks, along with Vicki Davis, here with you for the next 3 hours as we once again document the crisis of our republic, the undermining of our national, state, and individual autonomy. And today is the 9th of September, 2017. A few more weeks and we'll be done with this year. Oh, I say a few more weeks. It's actually a few more months. But it'll seem like a few more weeks, the way things are going. Good morning, Vicki.
Good morning.
How are things going in your neck of the woods?
Beautiful weather. No complaints.
Yeah, well, I wish we could say the same for the folks in Florida. Now it looks like I was just looking it up this morning, and we're looking, I guess, at a West Florida coast impact with this Hurricane Irma. We mentioned that Hurricane Irma was out there churning in the Atlantic last week. And back then, when we first talked about it, it was, I think, a Category 2, about to strengthen to a Category 3. Now it is currently, as I look at my program here, it looks like it's currently a Category 3 because it's been over Cuba and weakened a little bit. But it's set to strengthen again to a 4, and it looks like the cone has it going over Cape Coral and Sarasota, St. Petersburg, Tampa, and on up the Florida coast. So it's going to be interesting. It always is interesting to watch these things. But what's interesting about this is seeing the media's reaction to it and the promotion, the ever complete, everybody's losing their minds. Oh, this must be global warming. We're finally seeing the results of global warming, as if we've never had weather events. We've never had hurricanes before. Yes, this is seemingly shaping up to be a bad hurricane season, but how many hurricane seasons have we had that have been completely quiet for the most part? We've had several years of relatively quiet hurricane seasons. And now the first bad one, and it's like, global warming, sound the alarm, we're all going to die.
Well, and coincidentally, after Trump refused to sign on to the climate change initiative in Paris.
Yeah, the Paris Climate Agreement, which really ultimately doesn't really matter anyway, as we've talked in ad nauseum on this broadcast about, because your cities are implementing it without the national participation. So, yeah, everything is a contradiction today. I'm looking at an article here in the Associated Press. Winds, fire, floods, and quakes, a nutty run of nature. They say with 4 big hurricanes, a powerful earthquake, and wildfires. And I guess we've never had an earthquake anywhere on the planet either, right?
Right.
A powerful earthquake and wildfires. We have wildfires every year, ladies and gentlemen. It seems that nature recently has just gone nuts. Some of these disasters, like Friday's earthquake in Mexico, are natural. Oh, really? Others may end up, I thought they were all natural, but hey. Others may end up having a mix of natural and man-made ingredients after scientists examine them. We also always tend to look for patterns and order in chaos, even when they aren't there, psychologists say. Nature's gone crazy, mused Jeff Master, meteorology director at the private service Weather Underground. Welcome to the future. Extreme weather like this is going to be occurring simultaneously more often because of global warming.
What, things have been so quiet for so long. I mean, this is like a major opportunity.
Yeah, I guess if you wait long enough, you're going to have a bad storm season.
It's well, just, that's
it,
the trick,
it
isn't
just it? Drives me crazy. So, anyway, this is going to be something to watch. And, you know, I've got some more stuff on the hurricane here as time progresses here. But I wanted to talk about this Equifax hack. Did you see this?
Yeah, I did. And interestingly enough, last week I got a postcard in the mail telling me that I was a potential member of a class in a class action lawsuit. And it did involve Equifax. And if I joined the class,
if you joined
a couple of free credit reports.
if you join the class, you got a couple of free credit reports.
Yeah, that's what. You know those class action lawsuits.
Yes.
The only people that make any money on them are the lawyers.
Yeah, that's true. Although, honestly, I think they're worried about a class action lawsuit here, because from what I understand. Now, I've heard this. I'm getting this secondhand. I have not gone in and tried to do it myself, but they have set up a website on their. Let's see. I got it here somewhere. Give me just a second. It is Equifax2017.com. Now, what's interesting about this website is I use for my home DNS servers, I use OpenDNS. I don't use the internet assigned, you know, my internet company's assigned DNS servers because they tend to be a little slower. And so I use OpenDNS. Well, OpenDNS was actually blocking the Equifax security site as a phishing site. The special one that they set up for this particular incident?
Oh, I'll be darned.
They were blocking it for a while. Now, it's not blocked anymore, at least not as of last night. But it's EquifaxSecurity2017.com. And what they do on there is they tell you about the breach, and then they provide some forms for you to fill in the last six digits of your Social Security number and your last name, and they'll tell you if you may have been compromised. Now, bear in mind, this thing is huge. Half the country, 143 million customers, are at risk, apparently have been exposed.
Well, that sounds like pretty much all the adults in the U.S.,
well,
that would have credit.
Yeah. Well, it's a huge number of people. Let's put it that way. I don't know what their ages would be, but it's massive. And this is just a prime example as to why you don't have your stuff. You don't put critical, important information on to where it can get access to the internet. I mean, we've said this over and over and over again, and this is a perfect example of that.
Now, well, you know what, though? Let me tell you something. In Idaho, I needed a copy of my divorce papers, and so I drove to the state capitol and went into the Bureau of Statistics. And, you know, I've done things, you know, a birth certificate or marriage, you know, whatever. They closed the Bureau of Statistics office there. You could fill out a form and put it in a box, or you could go online and request a copy of whatever record it is that you wanted from the Bureau of Vital Statistics. Well, in order to get that, you have to put in all of the critical information. You know, your birth date, your birthplace, your Social Security number, your mother's maiden name, you know, all of this information that is considered to be the core of, you know, your private information for security purposes. So you, at least here in Idaho, you can't help but put your information in online if you need a copy of a vital statistic record.
Well, my point is not so much you. I'm talking about the people who are storing this information, be it a company or a government entity, or even if we're not even just talking about information, we're talking about infrastructure and important things that you don't want compromised or that would be catastrophic if they were. Why expose certain things to the internet? I see what you're saying. I mean, by virtue of the fact that you have to go online, it has to be available to you in order to do that, which would require exposure to the internet. This is a problem, and I think in the case of convenience, we're ending up sacrificing security in a major way.
Oh, no question about it. That is what you just said there. That is the key thing. You know, do people really need to have instantaneous answers or instantaneous access if it means compromising the security of their information?
Well, and the reason why this is so important, of course, I was just talking to my youngest daughter, Hannah, the other day about this. We're moving toward, whether we like it or not, and I certainly don't like it. If you think back, when the Social Security system first was set up, it was never supposed to be used. In fact, the earlier card said that this number is not to be used for identity purposes. You weren't supposed to use it for identifier. And now it's become just that. And now, instead of Social Security numbers and driver's license numbers and things like that, now we want to move toward this whole new era, this whole new area of using biometric information for an identifier. And this is extremely bad.
They'll just hash it down into a number. Everybody will always be identified with a number of some sort.
But what I see, and hashing is one thing, but when you get down to a point where your fingerprints are still there, if they don't properly encrypt them, and we're not just talking about fingerprints, we're talking about retina scans, facial recognition, all this stuff will somehow be floating out there. And we've already known some of the big players in the smartphone industry, for instance, have used biometric information to open up the phones. They're not doing it right. There was that scandal back a while ago where Samsung, I think it was Samsung, if I'm wrong, somebody correct me, but I believe it was Samsung, was who's not new to this game, by the way. They were storing thumbprints of the users in the clear on the phone. Now, things like that, we're heading head first into a brick wall of disaster when we go down this road. And I don't know that there's any way other than waking up the larger population and people seeing the importance of this to stop it.
Yeah, I don't think they ever will. They don't understand the need for privacy. So if you don't understand the need for privacy, you certainly can't understand how all of your private information stored in one place and accessible would harm you. So
yeah, here's the Equifax CEO.
On July 29th of this year, we discovered that attackers had gained unauthorized access to certain Equifax data files. We acted immediately to stop the intrusion. We promptly engaged a leading cybersecurity firm, which has been conducting a comprehensive forensic review to determine the scope of the intrusion. We also reported the event to law enforcement and continued to work with authorities. The unauthorized access occurred between mid-May.
Okay, now get this. This is, these people knew about this in mid-May. This is the other point I wanted to bring up about this. To me, this is criminal negligence. That they took all this time, mid-May is when they found out about this, instead of immediately going to the people and telling them that they were vulnerable. And again, we're talking about half the country. Now, they may not, obviously I could see maybe wanting to get a couple of weeks to try to get their act together and figure out just how big it is so that they have good facts. Okay, I'll give them a couple of weeks to get what they're going to say together. Okay? But they knew about this for the entire month of August. June? Mid-May. That would put them June, July. We're just finding out about this in September. Why did it take until now to learn about this? This is criminal negligence, in my opinion. Now, I'm not an attorney, but somebody needs to go to jail here, I think.
Access occurred between mid-May and July. I'm pleased to report that the review found no evidence of unauthorized activity on our core credit reporting databases.
Whatever that means.
This is clearly a disappointing event and one that strikes at the heart.
Disappointing. He describes it as disappointing.
Of who we are and what we do. I deeply regret this incident.
Mm-hmm.
And I apologize to every affected consumer and all of our partners. We all know that the threats to data security are growing by the day. And while we've made significant investments in cybersecurity, we have more to do, and we will. This incident is a test for all of us at Equifax. It tests our values, and it's a test to our resolve. I know you all agree that our first priority must be to support consumers. To that end, we're taking an unprecedented step of offering every U.S. consumer in the country a comprehensive package of identity theft protection and credit file monitoring at no cost.
And I would be quite very careful about reading the terms of service if you decide to sign up for this thing. Because from what I've understand from other people, and I have not done it myself, again, this is secondhand information, but it makes perfect sense to me. Certain people have stated that when they go in to sign up for this free credit monitoring, you have to agree to binding arbitration. In other words, you contractually agree that you will not go after them in a lawsuit. So another thing too
is that if they're monitoring all of your credit, then that means that they're going to want to obtain all of your credit information, you know, who you owe money to, what the account numbers are, and just keep track of that, which means that they've created a full portfolio of financial information on you.
Yeah, so, well, they have some of that already, but they don't have the stuff from the TransUnion and the... what's the other one?
I'm blanking on the
third one now. Equifax, yeah. TransUnion, and it doesn't matter. But anyway, the big thing about this story too, there's another thing here, and that is that they didn't announce this breach before three of their executives sold $1.8 million in stock. They announced it after the stock was sold.
Mm-hmm.
Which leads me to believe, you know, insider trading, hello, you know?
Yeah, pretty much.
And then
of course, we know that they can do that because of the Enron deal. You know, that's exactly what the insiders at Enron did.
Well, they sent Martha Stewart to prison for this very same thing, insider trading. So how are these guys? How do they get away with it? That's what I want to know. Apparently, she's not connected.
Example of somebody.
Yeah.
Better than Martha Stewart.
Yeah, exactly. We'll get the cupcake lady. You know, it was James Comey that sent her, that prosecuted her, I believe. CBS News says three senior Equifax executives sold a combined $1.8 million in company stock just days after the company discovered a massive security breach. Equifax said Chief Financial Officer John Gamble, boy, there's a name for you, and two other executives, Rodolfo Ploder and Joseph Loughran, sold their shares on August 1st and 2nd, just days after Equifax detected the hack on July 29th.
You know what, though? Going back to what that representative of the company, he said that Equifax's core databases with credit histories was not...
It was not compromised.
Violated.
Yeah.
It was just a data access breach. I mean, what does that really mean? Did they hire a contractor who got into a file that he shouldn't
have? We don't really know.
Exactly.
We don't really know. I mean, he says it's... That's why I said whatever that means when he said that. We don't really know what's been compromised. If something's been accessed, how do we really know what's been compromised?
Right. And if it's not their core credit histories that affects customers, then why are you doing this, you know, telling everybody that their credit history has been violated?
I think people need to know, but they need to know when it happens.
There are attempts to hack their systems on a daily basis. Now, the last one place that I worked at, I worked on electronic data interchange, which is the way that corporations communicate with each other. And basically, they were transactions that went PC to PC. And the transactions were unencrypted and offloaded to a mainframe file, and then they were run against the database. So, you know, the databases of that company were not online, were not accessible online. Mm-hmm. And I would imagine that, you know, most communications between corporations would be that way. So when they announce a hack like Equifax did, precisely what was it that was hacked? You know, was it a PC system, you know, that accepts EDI transactions? Or was it their mainframe system? They don't ever tell you that stuff.
No, they don't ever tell you because they don't want you to know. I just got a feeling it's very bad. I mean, if they don't disclose details, that's a pretty good indication that it's much worse than you might believe.
Well, I don't necessarily believe that. I mean, if they created a lot of drama, absolutely they did. But that drama could actually serve a purpose for the corporation.
I don't know how.
I don't trust anything.
I don't trust anything either. But it seems like it could backfire tremendously on them too.
Well, that's
because
true.
You're dealing with inviting government regulation, which is the last thing corporations typically want.
Oh, they've always been regulated, very highly regulated.
Yeah, but you don't want more regulation.
After a point, there can't be any more because otherwise, you know, the government's just taken over your business.
Yeah, that's true. Well, you could say the same thing for any bank. But they still seem to have a way of making off with all your money.
Well, Equifax isn't a bank, though, right? They're just a credit reporting.
You're right, although they are brokers of your information. They sell services which are tied closely to your information. I mean, they're tied in with that whole financial system. And that's the other thing, is I think that needs to be looked at. That is really, in my opinion, a conflict of interest. When you're a broker, you have control of people's private information, and you're able to sell that to third-party companies. how is that not a conflict of interest? But they offer these services.
I'd say the same thing about our driver's license information, right? Information has become a commodity. People have become commodities. There's nothing sacred anymore. No honor, no integrity.
That's true. It's depressing, but true. All right, I think we've talked that thing to death, but outrage is continuing to grow. I don't know if anything will ever come out of it, but anyhow. Also, speaking of hackers, apparently hackers have gained access to direct access to U.S. power grid controls.
Oh, gee, what a surprise.
Yeah. Yeah, Wired says, in an era of hacker attacks on critical information infrastructure, I can't talk today for some reason. Even a run-of-the-mill malware infection on an electric utilities network is enough to raise alarm bells. Symantec on Wednesday revealed a new campaign of attacks by a group it is calling Dragonfly 2.0, which it says targeted dozens of energy companies in the spring and summer of this year. In more than 20 cases.
You don't suppose it could be the communist Chinese renewable energy farms, solar farms, do you?
I wouldn't be a bit surprised. All right, we're at the bottom of the hour already. Let's hang tight, and we'll be back in a moment. This is Govern America. Welcome back to the broadcast. This is Govern America. The website is governamerica.com. That's governamerica.com, and the phone lines are open, 844-646-8376, if you'd like to call in. That's toll-free, 844-6-GOVERN, 844-646-8376. And if we had a theme for today's broadcast, I think it would be betrayal, because we have a lot of that going on right now at the federal level. With the Trump administration, no less. It's very disappointing to see some of the things come out. And one of the things I'm talking about here also is the fact that Trump's Justice Department just let Lois Lerner off without any charges. They've decided to drop the charges. You'll recall Lois Lerner was the IRS, the woman at the IRS during the Obama administration that was in charge of 501c3 organization approval. And they've now reviewed the case, they say, and they're not going to file any charges against her. She was at the height of a massive scandal when all of this was going on. Now, setting aside, of course, the fact that I don't think anybody should be seeking 501c3 tax-exempt status from the federal government, because they can control everything you say when you do that. But this is just yet another example, though, of having the possibility, just like the Clintons. Why are the Clintons out free? Why are the Clintons not being pursued for their crimes? And I come back to George Soros. Why isn't George Soros not being pursued, investigated, at least investigated? But that's not even talked about. It is just an absolute stabbing in the back of the American people and of conservatives, the conservative base. And there's a lot more of that where that came from, and we'll get to more of that as time progresses, I'm sure.
I think we have a government. I mean, I do believe there was a coup d'etat on our government, and these things that are happening and that continue to happen that are inconsistent with American law and the American way of life, I think they are on orders by this core group of people embedded within our government that basically have a shell around themselves. And I don't know whether they intimidate government employees, but I do think that the government employees who testify to Congress are more afraid of whoever it is that is in within the shell than mm-hmm. they are the Congress.
Yeah.
So, and it doesn't seem to be that, to me, that Jeff Sessions is piercing that shell at all.
No.
And I believe the reason for that is because I think it is centered within the Justice Department and the military in their legal divisions.
Yeah. And, of course, we have this week will mark the 16th anniversary of the false flag event, speaking of the shadow government, that was pulled off by the shadow government September 11, 2001. They pulled off a coup d'etat and brought the Twin Towers, the World Trade Center, down, and also the Pentagon was hit, I believe, with explosives because it wasn't an airplane.
No, I think it was a missile.
Yeah, I think it was a missile. Regardless of what it was, the point is that this was the springboard for fulfilling the plan for the never-ending war of terror. And I say of terror because we've been terrorized ever since. Middle Eastern countries have been terrorized ever since. There's nothing, and you pointed, the reason I bring this up is because you pointed out a meeting, a conference this past week, talking about, you know, with the former 9/11 commission members. The chair and vice chair were there. So I got a couple of sound bites, and they basically say the same thing. You know, this is a generational war. This is Lee Hamilton, the former 9/11 commission vice chair, and this is his assessment on the war of terror.
Well, of course, your question is...
Now, the quality of this is poor, of this particular guy, because... apparently, these guys know nothing about technology.
And you see how old they are.
Yeah, they're very overmodulated and, you know, well, over a lot of things. But anyway.
Exactly the question that's on the minds, I believe, of most Americans. We've been fighting this war against terrorism for a long time.
16 years, and we haven't made any progress. Terror is... It has never been a greater threat than it is today.
16 years, spent a lot of money.
Spent a lot of money.
Spent a lot of reorganization of government. Mm-hmm. Put the best minds we have in the country in many ways on national security.
God help us.
And yet, as Jason reminded us in his opening comments, terrorism is still alive and well.
Mm-hmm.
So how can that be, and why aren't we making more progress? That's the big question. Now, with regard to the 9/11 Commission and your question specifically, Tom is right on target, as he usually is. We said there were two enemies. One was Al-Qaeda, and the other was a terrorist extremist movement. We anticipated that this would be a generational struggle. I think it goes far beyond the 16 years. So I think the 9/11 Commission had it pretty well sized up. Certainly we could not indicate the details of it. Terrorism is an adaptive evolutionary movement. And we have to be prepared to be in it for the long haul. I don't think we are close to seeing the end of terrorism. So the struggle goes on, and it will be at least generational.
At least generational, he said. Yeah, there's a lot of money being made.
If you're fighting the wrong enemy, or you're doing lateral action against an alleged enemy, yeah, you'll never defeat that enemy.
Well, the enemy keeps changing because we keep funding the enemies.
That's right.
We're shadow boxing ourselves in the dark.
That's right.
I mean, this is it's like eating your own tail.
Uh-huh. It's kind of like a judo, you know. We're using our own force against ourselves.
Yeah, that's exactly what we're doing. Now, the moderator then turned to Tom Keene and asked him for his assessment. And now, he was the chairman. The other guy, the last guy we played, was the vice chair. This guy was the chairman of the 9/11 Commission. And he likewise called it generational.
Okay. Thank you, Lee. I'd like to follow up in part on both your response and Tom's here. And that would be with respect to the response of the U.S. government. You know, we've done a lot of things since 9/11. And yet it's been said that governments just don't do very well combating an ideology. So how do you size up the government response from 9/11 to the present day?
Well, you know, in many ways it's been pretty darn good. I mean we've spent a lot of money.
There's a metric for you.
A lot of people, including members of Congress, have been leaders in this fight. And we've basically prevented any major 9/11 type attack on the homeland. And that's a big accomplishment, because they want to kill us. They want to hurt us as badly as they can. And so the effort is to attack in the United States, and we've prevented that. On the other hand, we haven't been so successful on the lands of some of our allies. There have been major attacks in Great Britain and France, recently in Spain. As long as they're alive and attacking our allies and metastasizing or spreading around the world, so that they are, as Congressman Cole mentioned, they're in the Philippines now, on the second largest island, as long as they're growing in some places in Indonesia, as long as they're going around the Horn of Africa and spreading in that way, we're in danger. And so unless we really find a way to start decreasing rather than letting spread this very extreme form of one of the world's great religions, then sooner or later we're going to be in even more trouble in the homeland. So this is, as we said in the 9/11 report, a generational problem, and we're going to have to treat it that way and attack it where it lives, not just with troops on the ground, but with other means to hopefully eventually destroy it.
The war is never ending. That's what I'm hearing.
Right, and what he said there about, and now they're in the Philippines. Well, I remember in the 1990s when Muslims were in the Philippines, and although they weren't calling them Muslims, they were calling them terror groups that were terrorizing people. And I remember they held Christians hostage and all kinds of stuff. But after 9/11, well, what began as a project to protect critical infrastructure began with the bombing of the Oklahoma City building. That started the project for the protection of critical infrastructure. And after 9/11, where they blew up not only a private sector building owned by the Port Authority, by the way, they blew up Building 7, which is a government building, mm-hmm. Which is why a lot of the testimony in 9/11 brought in members of the Critical Infrastructure Protection Committee. But the thing is, if you look at it logically, step back and look at it logically, the thing was cybersecurity. Does that make any sense to you at all? It doesn't to me.
Are you saying the goal was cybersecurity?
Well, that was the solution.
Okay.
The critical infrastructure protection project, or call it project, it's actually become a major arm of our government, basically, a hidden arm of our government. The solution was cyber. information systems to protect critical infrastructure. It doesn't compute, you know? It just simply doesn't.
Well, I come back to the report from Iron Mountain on the possibility and desirability of peace. You know, this supposed hoax or supposed satire that was produced came out of somewhere. Leonard C. Lewin took credit for it. But the thing nailed it right on the nose. You know, they need a phantom. They need a boogeyman to be able to accomplish all their goals and control the population. And war is very effective at doing that. The environment is, here we are with the storm weather modification programs and hurricanes and earthquakes and, you know, all this.
All the things that people can't do anything about.
Mm-hmm.
And the fraud is apparent when you think, you know, they're building up the Muslim Al-Qaeda boogeymen. At the same time, they're massively importing them into our country through the refugee program, through foreign direct investment, allowing them to buy their way into our country. Intellectual fraud of the electric grid being under threat, but allowing the communist Chinese to open up renewable energy facilities, which makes them a utility operator, by the way. Yeah. That is the significance of these renewable energy farms, the solar farms or whatever. They become utilities. So we're allowing the communist Chinese to become utilities in our country.
Yeah, well, it's
everything
the same thing
is an intellectual fraud once you scrape off the surface facade.
Yeah, and what it seems like I recall they wanted to take over cell phone companies, or at least buy out certain cell phone companies, and I believe that was stopped at the time, but only after a big outcry. Was arisen out of it because people were screaming that this is a national security threat.
Yeah, well, and the same thing, you know, I remember around 2001 when the communist Chinese wanted to an oil company. I mean, under this plan of foreign direct investment. Basically, they've been turning our economy into state capitalism, communist Chinese system of state capitalism, where the government is actually partnered with the corporations in an economic sense, not just policy, but in an economic sense to where the government has a stake in the business.
Mm-hmm.
And It looks to me like that has been the objective.
Yeah.
The new economic thinking. It's actually, I think, the Soviet thinking for the 21st century. You know, countries will be businesses.
Yeah. Yeah, it sounds good to the people who believe in a free market. The problem is... It is a free market only for those who are the top, the most wealthy people there are. You know, it's a free market only for the big corporations. If you try to compete, you try to have a business, you're not going to be able to. You're literally going to be competing with, you know, Fortune 500 companies, a massive.
Or a foreign corporation that's owned by the government of a foreign country.
Yeah, state-owned.
Like,
yep.
Yeah, when I first started researching what was going on in Meridian, Idaho, which ultimately I found out became a fusion center, the economic development group there was trying to bring in a company called Sinomac. Well, Sinomac is a communist Chinese owned by the government of communist China. It's not a company, a corporation, in the way that we think of it. It's actually a state-owned asset.
Well, that's the whole thing with China. All of their corporations are state-owned,
mm-hmm.
aren't they?
Yeah, I think so.
It wouldn't be a communist government if they weren't.
Yeah, they might allow street vendors to sell stuff, but
are they really corporations?
Of any significance, the government is partnered with. They actually aren't even private sector. You can't say that they are private sector if the government owns a stake.
Yeah. Yeah, I just can't. I remember the words of one of those officials who said that China is our future. China is our future. And,
yeah,
then, you know, of course, our governor here in Michigan is over there. Mm-hmm. I believe right
yeah,
now.
Yeah, your governor there in Michigan.
He's a total scumbag.
What a piece of garbage that guy
yeah,
is.
Yeah, total scumbag. I call him Red Rick.
Yeah. Well, we have one here in Idaho, too. I call him the resident rodent, Butch
That's
Otter.
A great name. Resident rodent. I tell you what, we got a call on the line. Well, we did have a call on the line. I guess they dropped. All right, caller, you can call back, and if you want to call back. Some people call the phone just to see if we're live. You know, I give the date every hour. I don't know if that's why they were calling or not. Anyway, I want to get back to the hurricane for just a moment. Here's a little backgrounder from CBS.
President Trump declared an emergency today in Florida, Puerto Rico, and the U.S. Virgin Islands, all threatened by the most powerful Atlantic hurricane ever seen. Irma, a Category 5, has already turned deadly on the islands of the Caribbean. The National Hurricane Center says chances have grown for a direct hit on Florida, possibly as soon as the weekend.
This wall of wind and rain is only getting worse tonight as hundreds of Puerto Ricans are already in shelters and more than 200 tourists from this hotel have been evacuated out of their rooms and into a ballroom where they're expecting a very long night in the storm.
Residents were warned to brace for the worst as the strongest winds in a century lashed Puerto Rico. Irma has already left plenty of evidence of its record-setting strength. Wind gusts topped 200 miles per hour, knocking out power as buildings collapsed and debris flew. St. Martin took a direct hit. Wind and pelting rain blew palm trees horizontal. Boats were left tangled in the port as cars were nearly submerged. One tourist tweeted that the noise of the storm was insane and was like standing behind a jet engine. He took shelter in the concrete stairwell of a hotel. In St. Bartholomew, roofs flew off buildings. Streets became rivers as Irma continued its destructive trek past the British Virgin Islands on its way to the Florida Keys.
So there you go. Now, one thing that's kind of interesting, in fact, you know, we talk a lot on this broadcast when these types of events take place, whether or not this is a manipulated storm. We don't really know. And the problem is there's no way really to know. And this is why weather modification technology is perfect. It provides plausible deniability for any storm system, but the timing of this seems very, very suspicious, as we've talked about. You know, here Trump pulls us out of the Paris Climate Accord, and all of a sudden you have the whole world coming apart at the seams, it seems like. Wildfires, earthquakes, tsunami alerts, and multiple hurricanes at the same time. It's like all the predictions of Al Gore's Inconvenient Truth coming to fruition right after Trump pulls us out of the Paris Accord. And so what are we to make of this? You know,
it's Armageddon.
Well, Armageddon, yeah, or Irmageddon.
Irmageddon, there you go.
But anyway, the Miami Beach mayor used a term that was kind of interesting.
So my next guest is mayor of a community under mandatory evacuation right now, and he has called Irma a, quote, nuclear hurricane, and it feels like that for the islands that have been in its path so far. Philip Levine is the mayor of Miami Beach, Florida.
We began telling people to leave Miami Beach about 3 days ago, before mandatory evacuation. We take this storm incredibly serious. That's why I called it a nuclear hurricane.
A nuclear hurricane.
That is just so Ridiculous.
Clearly, he's talking code, Vicky.
Sure, yeah.
Yeah, I'm joking, of course. But speaking of interesting things that were said in the media about the storm, Sheldon Day sent me this short clip from the Weather Channel. It also is kind of bizarre.
All right, Chad, water can be weaponized. That's what you've been telling us. That's what we hear from the officials down here. Standing water can be used to flood areas. It can knock out power. But let me get Chad back for a second, because this dirty side of the storm thing, I want to hear more about that.
I don't know what he meant by that. Standing water? Water can be weaponized?
Well, you could, I mean, yeah, you could, you know, put weaponized mosquitoes out, and they would breed like crazy.
Why would you want to do that?
If you have a flood, there's all kinds of nasty things that get into the water, and, you know, it makes it a health hazard.
Hmm. But that's something that just happens organically.
Yeah, well, it's
the weaponization of standing water.
And it's been happening absolutely forever. It's nothing new, but they're making it seem like it's
weaponized.
You know, this is something new and deadly that's happening.
Yeah, it just struck me as really odd that he would use that terminology. You know. But anyway, there's a couple of sites that are kind of interesting that people need to be aware of. One of them, I thank the people that sent this to me. I think I got it more than one place. Weathermodificationhistory.com. It appears to be an excellent resource, providing timelines of the government's experimentation. They got cloud seeding ionosphere heaters, cloud ionizers, geoengineering. So, as I said, there is a timeline of events here, but they've done a lot of work on this website with documents and things like that. So I highly encourage people to check that out, weathermodificationhistory.com. And there's also another one that climateviewer.org. Climate Viewer, what you can do is it provides an interactive map where you can actually overlay not only radar systems and satellite imagery and this kind of thing, but there's a various things that they have, including nuclear sites and things like that. Simply by clicking on the item that you want to overlay over the map, you can even search for sunken ships on this thing. It's pretty amazing. But that's climateviewer.org for anybody who's interested in taking a look at that. I got a couple of phone calls on the line, so let me go ahead and take the calls here, and we'll get back to other things as time progresses. Hello, you're on the air.
This is Ken from West Virginia.
Mm-hmm.
A couple things about this storm, real quick. Talking about picking up strange bugs, somebody in Houston.
I'll tell you what, Kent, can you hang on just a second? I'm sorry, I got the top of the hour break. We'll get right back to you. Sorry about that.
Crisis of our republic, waging war on the new world order. This is Govern America. Govern America.
Well, just south of the Great Lakes capital city, covering all of North America via satellite, micro FM stations all across the country, and streaming live from FEMA Region 5 and Michigan Planning Region 2. This is the second hour of Govern America. Vicki Davis is here. I'm Darren Weeks, and it continues to be the 9th of September 2017 as we get right back into it. And I had to very rudely interrupt Kent in West Virginia. So, Kent, sorry about that. Continue on, please.
Yeah, a couple of things about this storm, and then I'll get into something else. Somebody down in Houston got talking about picking up in the water. Somebody got that flesh-eating bacteria, and he happened to be a firefighter. He was able to save himself. He recognized the problem he had. And then he's talking about media. There's a I'll send you a link to something. Mm-hmm. There's a Assange made a statement back late in December of last year or something that we're going to blow you away in 2017. So make of that what you will. I think there was something else behind that. But you were talking earlier about free enterprise, and you might be lucky to have a vendor. Now I'm going to tell you a story. This is a personal story, and relates to that. Now I grew up in around Washington, D.C., a Virginia suburb of D.C., and Marriott Corporation, the Marriott Corporation, the famous. But they were sort of famous around Washington because they started in Washington. Old man Marriott there was, and his wife had an A&W root beer stand, and they started out with a root beer stand, and they were diligent, blah, blah, blah. And they got a little restaurant, and then it all progressed, to this titan of the hotel industry was now. But in 1976, they had the bicentennial of the country, and old man Marriott was a big wig in the Republican Party, and so he gave they had a big chamber of commerce, a Republican, and he was up there and just bumping away, and there's no reason, and there's nobody in this country, this free enterprise and prevails in this country, and there's no reason nobody can't succeed. I did it, anybody can do it, and there's no excuse for nobody, and I don't want to listen to anything, blah, blah, blah. And come to find out, they did a big, long article about him. Well, they didn't. Comes to find out, while he was doing that, now his Marriott Corporation had made a contract with the Park Service and to give them exclusive license to vend on the park grounds.
Exclusive license.
Exclusive rights. And at the same time, old man Marriott, who started out as a vendor at a little A&W root beer stand, and he became a titan. He was thumping away up in some big hotel somewhere, and his henchmen were going around, and they got the park police to go around and arrest or push off the sidewalk guys selling T-shirts or maybe A&W root beer or something. So that's an honest to God true story. Hmm. And when you said that, well, you'd be lucky to have in the tie-in with the government and the big corporations. And you're exactly right. And at the same time, this man who started from a root beer stand and had gotten and had amassed all this great wealth and power, and he had contracted, and he had the park police go around and push all these little vendors who were trying to just get a little start and push them out of business. That's a true story.
Yeah.
Well, that's really good information. I didn't know that it was Marriott that got the park concessions, but that always really bothered me because when I was a teenager, what the teenagers would do from Idaho Falls is they would, in the summer, they would go get jobs up in the college students. I went up there with a girlfriend after we graduated from high school and got a job in West Yellowstone. But once the concession was contracted out to somebody, then they were bringing in adults from all over the world, and they would wear a name tag that said what country they were from. And I just always thought that was really terrible because a lot of kids would go there to earn their college money, after high school. And so, and besides that, I think Marriott wasn't he a Mormon?
Yeah, he was a Mormon.
It's a Mormon company.
Yes.
Okay, well, there you go. The Mormons are very connected in with the FBI and the CIA, and so I would say that was a political contract. Anytime, you know, there's an individual business or an individual that they tell a story about, you know, oh, he started in his garage or he started as, you know, like you say, A&W Root Beer, and they build a multi-billion dollar business. I have to say BS on that. You know, they have connections, and they were built up for a purpose. I've just become such a cynic, you know, about business. I almost just don't believe the American story of the entrepreneur anymore.
Well, the American dream.
Yeah.
You know, that's these stories seem to be promoting the idea that you can succeed if you work hard enough and you just do all this stuff. And, you know, I think we should work hard at anything we do, but that isn't the point. You can work hard, and many have, and they don't succeed. They fall by the wayside.
If you do build up to something, then somehow they will take it away from you. So you build it, and they will take it.
Go ahead, Ken.
Speaking of connections, I ran across something that Bill Gates, now we all have heard the story, well, he was at Harvard and he dropped out and started out this. And there was some guy, I'm sure you know, Vicki, his name, Gary Kildall, essentially he was an early pioneer in programming. And I've got a video I'll send to you. But he apparently developed what is maybe actually the precursor of Microsoft or Windows or MS-DOS, I guess it was at that time. And he was out in Silicon Valley and palling around with Bill Gates. And essentially, it's made to appear in this documentary that Gates sort of copied it derived a lot from Kildall. And it turns out that Gates and Kildall's were giving a marketing trial with IBM to see which one would succeed. And it turns out Bill Gates' mother was big in the United Way, and in the United Way, she hobnobbed with the chairman of IBM. And what happened was when they put out trial runs of these operating systems, they priced Gary Kildall's at, I think it was $240, and he priced Bill Gates at, I think, $60 or $40. So they essentially, you know, the disparity in the pricing of the operating system, you know, obviously Bill Gates has won out in the marketing test. So, you know, there's something that is, as you say, you know, all these stories where, he dropped out of college and he struggled, you know, he dropped out of college and his mother knew the CEO of IBM and everything was opened up for him. So you're exactly right there.
Yeah,
I'll send you I think his father was also involved with Planned Parenthood, if I recall correctly. But, yeah, United Way keeps popping up in very interesting ways. Elaine Chao, the U.S. Transportation Secretary that I keep harping about, she was also involved with the United Way. I really believe that the United Way was nothing really but a big slush fund, a leftist slush fund.
Well, and you're talking about businesses that are started in basements or garages and things like that. Let's take a look at Google. It seemingly came out of nowhere. All of a sudden, seemingly overnight, it's a massive thing and grows where it doesn't really seem to have any real big funding. I mean, any means of funding. I mean, little ads on its search engine, but that was it to begin with. Now it's got other real sources of revenue stream. But this thing has taken over the internet.
Yeah, I'm sure that Google was started by the CIA. I think it was probably started by InQtel.
And now it's controlling speech on the internet. It's crushing ideas and opinions and sites that it doesn't agree with. And then you have Facebook doing the same thing. Another company, supposedly started by this Mark Zuckerberg, came out of nowhere, and now it's this big, massive, dominant, you know, thought control machine.
Yeah, Zuckerberg. I can't help but think of the Joker. I don't know why, but I I just associate him with the Joker.
Yeah. So anyway, Kent, I got to move on here because we got another call here, but I appreciate the call there.
Well, thanks.
All right. Talk to you later.
Oh, and by the way, Bill Gates did not develop DOS. I don't think he was he wasn't really the programmer. I don't think he's really a programmer. I think it was the other people that were with him, his partners, that were really the programmers.
Yeah, I heard that he stole it from him.
Yeah,
at least they ripped off their idea.
Uh-huh. Yeah, or actually bought it from them, from that guy that actually developed it and then sold it to IBM. So I don't really... Bill Gates, I think, has always been... You know who he looks like? He looks like the guy, Alfred E. Newman of Mad Magazine. And I really kind of think that he's...
somewhat of a caricature?
Yes, he's a caricature. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
He's not the brains, and he's the front face and became the money guy because he had the power and influence given to him by his connections, you know, his mother, his father,
yeah,
whatever.
And now he wants to kill people.
First, we've got population. Now, if we do a really great job on new vaccines, health care, reproductive health services, we could lower that by perhaps 10 or 15%.
I don't know why the media doesn't talk about this more. Oh, wait, yeah, what am I saying? How silly of me. Anyway, another call on the line. Let's go ahead and go back to the phones. And hello, Tennessee. Come on in.
Hello. Vicki, are you okay with the fires out there? Are they missing you?
Yeah, they're not around me. I think the closest they got to me was about 40 miles away. But, it seems like the whole West is burning.
Well, listen, the reason I called, Darren, you brought up Climate Viewer and you were talking about the hurricane. I've been on hold and actually lost my train of thought, but I'll try to get back on it real quick. In 2010, when we had Nashville flood, what struck my mind was the TVA, their whole idea of, you know, these lakes that they've impounded, and their mission statement was to be a flood control network where they could control the flooding. And I'm sorry, but words mean things. When you tell me you want to control flooding, that means that you don't want to stop it.
Yeah.
You want to control it. Mm-hmm. So when you spoke about standing water being used as a weapon, well, Shazam, in the words of, Gomer Pyle, that's mm-hmm. what they're doing. Yes, it can be weaponized. Yes, it can wipe out electricity. Yes, it can... What it's doing with us, wipe out petroleum supplies for a time until the water recedes, if they choose to allow it to recede. Then you've got, I don't know about Michigan, but here in Tennessee, we've got signs all over the state. You are entering the Red River watershed basin. You're entering the Caney Fork Rivershed watershed. They know where the water's going to go. They know how to control flooding. They know how to cause it too, folks. And it's really amazing to me.
Yeah, you know, the whole thing just kind of...
what they're doing.
It kind of just struck me as kind of odd. You know, I mean, I don't want to make too much of it because it could have been some kind of offhanded comment that the reporter or whoever he was, what Sheldon said was that he was he was recording off the Weather Channel, but the Weather Channel themselves evidently was using some of CNN's footage, so it could have been something that they were passing through, too, from CNN. But I do know that a lot of these networks have, you know, anchors, reporters, people who are actually double agents, are actually working for the CIA, too. So you've got that element in there where these could be connected people. And I just thought it was a very odd way of saying it when you've got standing water in the street, it, you know, to suggest that water can be weaponized. Well, certainly we have flooding going on in a major way. And, I don't want to make too much of it, but it was just kind of an odd comment.
Well, I don't know if you remember during the 1990s, but the news media was giving, they were basically the idea factory for the ways that terrorism could be used against our country. I mean, you know, it seemed like every night they had new stories of new ways for terrorists to harm our people.
Mm-hmm.
Eventually, somebody called him out on it and said, hey, you know, why are you giving these ideas to terrorists how they can hurt us?
Yeah, exactly. Well, we do that all the time.
I don't think it can be exaggerated, though. When you look at what's happening, you know, Darren, I sent you a link, I believe, to a YouTube video from, like, 1989, BBC's got a program called Top Gear.
Mm-hmm.
And the guy was in Mississippi at a NASA rocket engine testing facility. He used liquid hydrogen, liquid oxygen to create a cloud, a vapor cloud that was large enough to cause rain in Mississippi an hour later. And the comment that came out of the what the BBC calls a presenter, what came out of his mouth is, oh, my gee, NASA is playing God. Now, there's a guy named Richie in Boston. He's got a YouTube channel. And he actually did a satellite image of the Harvey hurricane. And when it turned and went back into Texas from the Gulf, NASA, the site in Mississippi, did a 500-second blast, creating this huge cloud in the middle of a hurricane. So when you take cold exhaust, which is hydrogen and oxygen, and you inject it in a already tremendous storm, you're increasing the intensity. If I have any kind of understanding of weather, and I'm not a weatherman, but it makes common sense, cold front and hot front colliding makes a bad storm. And they did this for 500 seconds, which, get this, divide that by 60, and it's 8.333 minutes that they shot this rocket off, making this huge storm cloud.
Well, so NASA actually, there was a New York Times article back several years ago now where NASA was actually shooting laser beams at Hurricane Debbie. And we know about Project Storm Fury, where they were trying to control storm systems and hurricanes that took place decades ago. So, I mean, these things, they've been in the works. You know, the Air Force document owning the weather in 2025.
Operation Popeye in Vietnam in the 1960s. Yeah.
Exactly. Exactly.
So they've been doing it. They're getting better at it. And they're, what, you know, look, when I was a kid in Detroit, Sonny Elliott was a great weatherman. He was never right, but he was a pleasure to watch. Okay? Never right. And these people now are never wrong. They can predict, you know, it used to be 3-day forecast. Now it's a 2-week forecast. Yeah. And they're, you know, they're wrong sometimes, I guess, because
they're wrong in my area.
The powers that be's plans change. Mm-hmm. You know, the plans change, but they're giving you a 2-week forecast telling you what the temperature is going to be in 2 weeks.
Well, if
I wonder if you do that,
if they're right in 2 weeks, we only have a 7-day forecast here. Now, I don't know about your.
Oh, we get a 10-day.
Okay, 10 days, 7 days. That's pretty close. I've worked with a number of meteorologists over the years, and I can tell you, one of their biggest complaints was always, having to do the seven-day forecast. Because their statement to me was, we can't predict that far out accurately. And now, sometimes they may be right. But the problem is that there's too many variables that change, can change, between now and then. So they just would like to do maybe a 3 or 4 day out. Maybe 3 would be probably ideal. But there's just too many variables that can change in predictions to predict that far out. And they don't like it, because if somebody sees the 7 day forecast and says, oh, it's going to be sunny on Saturday, and they make a plan, and then it doesn't pan out, it turns out they have rain, then they blame the meteorologist, and he says, you know, it's my reputation. But the problem is TV stations hire these consultants. If one starts to do it, because, you know, some executive listens to a consultant, and the consultant says, people, you need to do this. You need to get your meteorologist to predict this far out. And then they do it, and then everybody else in the market has to follow suit, because it's a highly competitive game. Well, they got a 7 day forecast, so I'm going to watch them instead.
Let me ask you this.
Yeah, go ahead.
Let me ask you this, Darren. Have you noticed that the old-time meteorologists, whether it was a man or a woman, are going away? And the new ones that are coming in, they're not even calling them meteorologists. They're not, you know, they're bringing in, like Fox News is doing, or like the local stations in major markets are doing. They're bringing in either a handsome guy or a beautiful woman. And if it's a handsome guy, 9 times out of 10, he's walking on the wrong side of the street. And they're bringing these people in that aren't meteorologists. They're eye candy to give you the weather. And it's a computer forecast. It's not their forecast. It's a computer forecast. So it takes the responsibility or the repercussions of having a wrong forecast off of the prettier, handsome weather man or weather woman.
Well, what it does is it dumbs down the process if they're not real meteorologists, because meteorology, you have to get a degree. You have to actually understand
right.
the weather. That is a certification. You can't just call yourself a meteorologist. I mean, you actually have to be degreed.
Well, not only that, Darren, the very instruments that they're using to make their forecasts, like this NEXRAD radar, they create the weather with the NEXRAD, and they're using it to tell you what's going to happen. Well, my goodness, if you got a computer program and you're generating and controlling, and I know it sounds like a 1960 Rocky and Bullwinkle cartoon with an evil man saying, I'm going to control the weather, but they're doing it, folks, and they're making you believe that they're forecasting when they're... What is forecasting anyway, other than a dark science? You know, you're putting your cap on and looking into your crystal ball, making a forecast. You're foreseeing. That's occult art, people.
Well, I don't know if
I'd
go that far.
They're doing it.
I mean, you're...
Well,
you're,
I would.
Scientifically.
Yeah, but I'm known to go way over the
well,
edge.
Well, you're making a prediction based upon scientific data. And you can only do that to the extent that you're able to have accurate data, and the data has improved.
Well, I know if there's...
Go ahead.
I know enough to know that if the sky's red tonight, it's going to be nice tomorrow, and if the sky's dark tonight, you know, or red sky at night, sailor's delight, red sky in the morning, sailors take warning. That's all anybody needs to know. It works.
Right.
And even the Bible says you can discern the clouds, you know. You can discern the clouds, but you can't find the truth.
Yeah, I don't.
Yeah.
I don't plan.
I agree.
Red
there are
sky
too
tonight.
Many, too
I can go
variables.
On a boat tomorrow.
Yeah. Well, I don't.
Anyway,
I don't plan a lot of outdoor activities. Hey, thanks,
right,
John.
Take care of both of you.
Yeah, appreciate the call.
Bye.
All right, bye bye. What were you going to say, Vicki?
It is kind of voodoo science, because there just are too many variables. You know, and to have a... Now, maybe NASA has computing power capable of real calculated weather prediction. But you know, the little TV station guy, even a big TV station guy, they didn't have the computing power to be able to do that kind of thing. So it's an art, I think, an educated art, just like medicine.
Well, they have access to a lot more than they used to. I remember back when I started in television, they didn't have access to even radar. I remember distinctly our meteorologists at WILX actually had to go and dial up on a modem a weather location to download the latest radar picture right before the newscast. Now, a lot of stations have their own, I'd say a good majority of stations have their own radar right outside the building or somewhere nearby. So, I mean, things have massively changed, and even if they don't have their own radar, they have access to all of that data on the internet now. So jet stream patterns and everything, I remember they had these massive printers in the newsroom that would print out the jet stream. Uh-huh. On these massive dot matrix printers, and they were noisy as they could be, and they were always printing out different things from the wire, but they also printed out massive maps of the jet streams so that the meteorologists could decipher which way the patterns were going. It's really interesting how far we've come technologically.
When I was up in Alaska, I did a contract for ARCO, and when the geologists would get on the...
Can you hold on just a second and keep your thoughts in place? We got the bottom of the hour. Don't forget, we'll talk about Alaska when we come back. Stay with us, folks. Vicki Davis is here. I'm Darren Weeks. We'll be back in a moment. This is Govern America. We're back. This is Govern America. The website is governamerica.com. That's governamerica.com. Vicki's sites are thetechnocratictyranny.com, thetechnocratictyranny.com, and channelingreality.com. And she's also a contributor to The Voice of Idaho, and that is at tvoinews.net. Anyway, the phone number, if you'd like to call in, is toll free 844-646-8376. That's 844-6-GOVERN, 844-646-8376. And before the break, Vicki, I had to very rudely interrupt you there. The clock doesn't wait. You were just getting ready to tell us about when you worked in Alaska.
Okay. Yeah, what I was going to say is that when the geologists got on the machine to do their calculations, whatever it was that they were doing, they would bring the machine to its knees, to where we couldn't even work on it, just working at a terminal, writing a program or modifying a program or whatever. We had to wait until they were done doing whatever their calculations were. And that was a long time ago. That was in the 1980s. But if you transfer that thought and think about the weather, The machines are a lot faster nowadays, but they also have a lot more data to crunch. And so even though we have a lot of power in the computer systems today, the idea that they could crunch all of those variables, the massive amount of information, to come up with a prediction, that would be relatively accurate. Mm-hmm. I think it's probably hyped a lot more than what they can actually do. I think they can do a lot, but I just don't think that they can do it as much as we think that they can. Like, for example, one graphic I saw on TV, I was telling you about it, where they were tracking the path of Hurricane Irma. Mm-hmm. They had this hurricane going clear up to, like, Chicago. Chicago.
Yeah. Well, a lot of this stuff is actually based upon computer models. The cones and for the...
They're obviously not factoring in that when it hits land, it loses power. Yeah. And every mile it goes inland, it loses force. Mm-hmm. So...
Yeah, well, and everything's only as accurate. I mean, these projections, especially like, for instance, in the case of a hurricane, it's only as accurate as the different computer models are accurate. And some of them are kind of extreme, and some of them...
Are kind of stupid?
Well, they can be. I think the idea is to try to calculate based upon a lot of different factors, and I don't pretend to know how these things work and how much of, how heavy of a signal some factors are or over others. I'm sure there's a whole science involved in that, computer wise, which would probably get pretty complicated. I would think. I think mathematical certainties would probably play into how they determine that.
Yeah, I stayed away from scientific programming because I just don't have the math background. But there were always, you know, the programmers who did that kind of stuff, they were scientists themselves.
I would imagine you have to be pretty genius level to be able to do a lot of that stuff. Programming basic stuff is one thing, but when you're factoring in so many different things and having to decide which factors get more weight than others, how do you measure that? And I mean, I think it would get very confusing very quick. But anyway, getting back to the hurricane for just a second, you know, the propaganda machines, you know, as I said earlier, is going a big time. And now there's, they just came out with a story on MSNBC pushing the notion that sea level rise is being caused by, you know, climate change in Florida.
Chris Hayes has also made his way to Miami as well. Chris is going to be airing a special All In tonight, 8:00 Eastern. You were there last year as well for a special report on the conditions that make Miami uniquely susceptible to hurricane damage.
You know, Miami, when you look at analyses of what parts of America are most vulnerable to the effects of climate change, particularly sea level rise, Miami is right in the crosshairs. The reason is almost all of Miami-Dade is only 10 feet or lower above sea level. Huge amounts of it have constructed and dredged, actually. And so when you get a really big storm and a storm surge, which is a real concern in places like South Beach, you already have sea level rise. We came here and we looked at them fighting back the water on sunny days. Take a look.
Less than 9% of Miami-Dade County is greater than 10 feet above sea level.
Adding to the problem, most of South Florida is built on porous limestone, which allows water to move around easily and seep up through the ground.
Now notice the music to manipulate you. I mean, it's interesting how they added this music in here.
Flooding happens often here, and not just when it's raining. Seasonal high tides occur when the sun, earth, and moon align, leading to flooding made worse by sea level rise.
You can see that every day when you go into Miami Beach. At least in October, we will have 4 or 5 extreme flooding events when the sky is clear. It's just coming right up the sewer drains, flooding from sea level rise. That's a climatic impact that we're seeing already today.
So
you're
using this big
time.
Go ahead.
It makes me wonder what, you know, how much junk have they dumped off of Florida? Because I know that they were using things like old cars, at least they said this, that what the heck was it? That it had to do with the fish. Because it gave shelter to fish.
Are you kidding me?
No, I'm not kidding. I can't quite remember what it was, but that would cause sea levels to rise if you build up rather than a barrier wall, you've got a barrier pile of junk.
Yeah. Well, I'm gonna tell you right now, sea levels are not rising. I mean, this is
no,
all bull crap.
But it could seem like it, you know, if you dumped a lot of junk off your coast.
Yeah, but the oceans are so big. They're so massive.
Well, that's true, but we're talking about in the shallow waters just right off the coast.
Yeah. So. Well, what we're dealing with here is institutionalized fraud.
See if I can find stories.
Yeah, institutionalized fraud is what we're dealing with here. And by the way, already, you know, speaking of using this crisis for political purposes, we see from the Hill, the Senate panel votes to fund UN Climate Agency. This just came out on 2 days ago. A Senate committee voted Thursday, you know, right at fresh in the middle of all this hurricane stuff, to contribute $10 million to the United Nations Climate Change Agency. Senate Appropriations Committee voted 16-14 to approve an amendment by Senate Jeff Merkley from Oregon to restore funding for the UN's Framework Convention on Climate Change in the State Department Appropriations Bill. The payments that the United States had been made annually since joining the convention in 92 had been slated to be eliminated. So there you go. You know, seizing upon the crisis.
I don't know why we're providing any funding to the United Nations at all. It is a communist organization.
I agree. I couldn't agree more. And why would people donate to the Red Cross is another thing that I wonder about.
I do too. You remember after 9/11, the Red Cross was collecting so much money.
Yes, and they kept it. They came out and announced they were keeping the money.
They were going to build a system, an emergency management system, and it was Bill O'Reilly that called him out on it.
Well, I think all the media should call him out on it, and you know what? But yet the local media and the national media still trump up the Red Cross as being something great that people should give to. This is what I don't understand. You know, even NPR back in 2015 did a thing called, in fact, it seems like I remember reading this on the air when it came out, In Search of the Red Cross's $500 million in Haiti Relief. You remember the earthquake in Haiti?
Yes, I do.
Well, they say when a devastating earthquake leveled Haiti in 2010, millions of people donated to the American Red Cross. The charity raised almost $500 million. It was one of the most successful fundraising efforts ever. The American Red Cross vowed to help the Haitians rebuild, but after 5 years, the Red Cross's legacy in Haiti is not new roads or schools or hundreds of new homes. It's difficult to know where all the money went.
Well, you know what? There was a story that InfoWars did. Jerome Corsi was on this week, and he's been working with Charles Ortel, who has actually done a lot of forensic work on the financials of the Clinton Foundation. And I can't remember exactly what it was they found. I mean, it wasn't really startling, but... I was thinking that, well, what none of these people seem to understand is that money donated to the Clinton Foundation, they're involved in building the global health system.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're talking about medical assistance kinds of things, for third world countries. And the reason I was thinking this was because they did mention PEPFAR, which was the President's Emergency Commission on for HIV, AIDS, or something like that in 2003. They're actually building a global healthcare system. So if it's all in the presentation of how you present, how you're delivering assistance to third world countries. Mm-hmm. You know, you might say that you're delivering. The Clinton Foundation did. They bought AIDS drugs from some company in India that turned out to be counterfeit. But most of the money went for some other reason, and nobody knows what it is. Well, I say that it's IT infrastructure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I believe you.
Because what they are delivering to third world countries is information.
Yeah, well, I don't think the Haitian people had any information. In fact, I don't think they have much of anything. That maybe the government got information. But I think what really happened is they made off with all the cash.
Well, they in the story that I did on what the Clintons were doing over there, they were investing in an economic development zone. Mm-hmm. Okay, now if you look at, and I've looked at other places around the world, I've looked at a lot of places in the United States. What these zones are, they are at the transportation hubs, and they essentially they are port authorities. Now, how the healthcare system ties into that is that it's emergency management, all emergencies. Okay, so what the port authority is like a cover story for the fusion centers. And the fusion centers tie all of the critical infrastructure together. Your hospitals and, of course, your healthcare system is part of your critical infrastructure, and they are tied in at the zone. If people would only look at the structure of the systems that come into these inland ports, in our legislation, they've put a lot of the legislation for it under the heading of port security. Mm-hmm. Okay, because the transportation system is involved in it.
Yep.
Okay. So and of course you've got your smart grid, you've got the health IT systems, you have your water tie-in, you have your fire, your police, your justice system ties into it. These are hubs that they're essentially the panopticon, and they're at the at global hubs. And if you look at the intermodal commerce zones, which is what they are, where two forms of transportation come together, they use the transportation legislation to define the zone. And then they use other agencies of government and their piece of the action to come into the zone. And they basically build this watchtower panopticon system.
And this is why you got to be careful anytime you see another news story about Zika or some health crisis like Ebola. All of this stuff, we exposed how Ebola, for instance, was a big scam to create the health system. As a matter of fact, I got the, it was Chuck Hagel, I got the audio right here.
Whether we sit in defense ministries or health ministries, we all have a common interest in helping all nations, helping each other prevent and contain outbreaks. We must do this to support the development of healthcare systems and infrastructures that Secretary Burwell described a few minutes ago, building health security and capacity around the world.
So they were talking about...
There you go. See, that's it. When they say building capacity, what they're talking about is running the fiber optic cable, running the electricity, the water, the systems to, you know, to all over the third world. They're doing that. We are building the IT infrastructure for Africa.
And that's all throughout Agenda 21, by the way. They talk about capacity building throughout all of these UN documents. So this is a long-laid plan.
It is. And you know what? I found a report that said that the Russians, the Soviet Union, had email communications across the country before we did. They had it in 1989. Hmm. So all of this has been planned. You know, this. There was a movie, I think it was called The Corporation, how there was one corporation that ran all the systems of the world. And that's really where we're headed.
Yeah, I believe you're right. I believe
global
you're right.
Global government will be an IT consulting firm.
It's horrific to think about. But yeah, I mean, the scams are going forward. The fundraising schemes. Well, you know, we were just talking about the Red Cross. And we're talking about the Clinton machine in Haiti, the Clinton Foundation, what they did in Haiti. And Bush was involved in this, too. I mean, after Katrina, they had the Bush-Clinton-Katrina Fund.
Right. Well, the Bush family is involved in a lot of the systems.
Yeah, and they were involved in
Haiti. Bush was involved in education systems. But I don't know if I finished telling you that what the Clintons were involved in is the building of a zone in Haiti.
Mm-hmm.
And so,
unfortunately,
the guy who was the government, head of the government economic development unit there, he was murdered not too long ago, about a month ago, I guess.
Yeah, it seems like I remember hearing about that.
Mm-hmm.
But let's keep in mind what Bush said around 2010 during that time.
I know a lot of people want to send blankets or water. Just send your cash.
Yeah.
One of the things that President I'll do is to make sure your money is spent wisely.
Yeah.
That's one thing I always liked, appreciated about Bush is that he, in some of the things that he said, you know, he kind of gave away what they were doing. And I think he did it intentionally, actually.
Really?
Yes, because I think that 9/11 was planned during the Clinton administration. And I think the Bush, George... Now, maybe others. I know his father was involved in it, but I think it was a surprise to George. But he would say things like, one thing he said was, humans and fish can coexist.
Yeah, that's always nice to think about, isn't it?
Yeah, somewhere I've read there was a list of Bushisms.
Oh, yeah. We used to play him on the air during his administration. It was actually one of the more fun things about his administration, probably the only fun thing about his administration.
Absolutely. Yeah.
But, you know, now they're back, Vicky. They're back.
Hurricane Harvey brought terrible destruction, but it also brought out the best in humanity.
As former presidents, we wanted to help our fellow Americans begin to recover.
Our friends in Texas, including Presidents Bush 41 and 43, are doing just that.
People are hurting down here, but as one Texan put it, we've got more love in Texas than water.
We love you, Texan.
Donate to OneAmericaAppeal.org. We are all in this together.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So there you go. Go ahead and sign up. Sign right up.
Yeah, and they're all investing in the IT infrastructure. Disaster means money.
Yeah.
And it's not just money for, like he said, food and blankets and what. They don't care about that stuff. Just give them the money so that they can build the IT systems for the global management system.
Yeah, and people
is
think
what it is.
People think when they give to something like this, that any of the money is going to end up in the hands of victims. They're not going to give anything to victims, and this is why, you know, just give us your cash. We're not going to give you anything to victims. It's really sad. You got to wonder how people can be this absolutely immoral. I'm just astounded that we share the earth with monsters such as this.
Well, I really do think that they think that they are a separate species from us. I don't think that they they believe that our humanity is the same as theirs.
Yeah, I agree with you on that. By the way, there was an interesting article in the Cato Institute, because there was a lot of talk about how vulnerable Houston was to Harvey because of its zoning. And Vanessa Calder makes a good case that the lack of zoning was not Houston's problem. An urban fairy tale is emerging in the aftermath of Hurricane Harvey. She says commentators claim that because Houston lacks a traditional zoning code, Houstonians recklessly built a city with too many roads, buildings, and parking lots, and these impervious surfaces collected water rather than absorb it, exacerbating flooding. They argue Houston doesn't have enough absorbent surfaces with trees, grasses, and soil because of a lack of zoning. The facts don't support this story. It's true Houston is the only major U.S. city without conventional separate all land uses zoning, but this has not reduced absorbent surface cover relative to other cities with more aggressive regulation. She goes on to make the case, and I don't have time to read the whole article, but I'll put it in the show notes, that other cities with more zoning, the more zoning you have, the more likely you are to have less, you know, absorbent surfaces and this sort of thing. And Houston is not, I mean, like New York City, for instance, has a lot less absorbent surfaces than Houston does. And they're regulated to death zoning-wise. So it's kind of an interesting story, and I thought it was worth pointing out.
Yeah, it's kind of silly because you can't have enough absorbent surfaces for, you know, 4 feet of water. I mean, that's kind of just silly.
Yeah, I mean, there's things you can do to create better drainage and this sort of thing that would help mitigate a lot of this. But ultimately, I mean, even if you have a lot of absorbent surfaces, the ground can get saturated. So, you know,
that reminded me, when you mentioned that last week, I wanted to tell you that what Idaho did, there is an International Building Codes organization.
Yeah, International Code Council.
Yes, okay. Yes, and Idaho put that into law.
Oh, no. All right, tell you what, we're at the top of the hour. Let's take the break. We'll be back in a moment. This is Govern America.
The crisis of our republic, waging war on the new world order. This is Govern America. Govern America.
From just south of the Great Lakes capital city, covering all of North America via satellite, micro-FM stations all across the country, and streaming live from FEMA Region 5 and Michigan Planning Region 2, this is the third and final hour of Govern America. Vicki Davis is here. I'm Darren Weeks. We're here every Saturday. We hope you'll tell folks about the broadcast, your friends, your neighbors, maybe even your enemies, because they need to be educated, too. Anyway, it continues to be the 9th of September, 2017, and Vicki, you had just brought up the International Code Council right before the clock hit us again. Did you have anything else you wanted to add on that subject?
Yeah, I spoke with the Idaho legislator about that. You know, why did they do that? And he said, oh, we modified it because they found out right after implementing it that they were all of the daycare centers in Idaho were going to have to shut down because they didn't meet code according to the international code. But What a single code like that would do is that it would make some places overbuild and other places perhaps underbuild. I mean, where on earth did they get the idea that they could having a single building code was a good idea?
Yeah, centralized planning is what it really boils down to. And as we pointed out on, I think last week was when we talked about it. And we've talked about it off and on over the years, but the code enforcement officer is the person who really is who's really in charge of deciding whether or not the thing is going to be enforced or not in the first place. I mean, they can seize upon any little thing on your property and determine that you're in violation and fine you by the day until you can't pay these fines. If you're not able to bring yourself up to the satisfaction of the code enforcement official, they can literally take your property. I mean, they'll fine you so much to the point where you can't pay the fines, and then they can get your property. They don't even have to do. It's like Derry Brownfield said when he was commenting on this. It's an end run around eminent domain.
Yes, because and he was exactly right. Because they can just change the code, and they don't have to take into consideration what it's going to do to people in a particular area. It's like what they did with a backflow device here in Twin Falls or in Idaho. You know, they suddenly made it mandatory retroactively.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, it cost me $400 to get this backflow device brought up to code.
Yeah.
Well, right. You know, they can do that with any number of things, a continual amount of things, and just ultimately price us out of our homes.
Yeah, and already we're seeing housing prices go insane to the point where people can't afford to live in houses anymore. And the smart meters, I have to say, are a big part of this. My father-in-law and brother-in-law both have received smart meters on their houses back some months ago. Thankfully, I've been able to ward it off, you know, and it hasn't been easy, to be honest with you, because they've, even though I put them on notice, they were going to change it out. Luckily, thankfully, my wife was here at the time, and she was able to tell them, hey, you think you're going to put that on my house? You better think again. Well, they, but my in-laws weren't quite as lucky. One of them didn't heed my message. The other one was busy with his wife being in the hospital at the time, so he was gone when they came out to put the meter on the house. Anyway, they've seen their power bill go from like under $100 to being over $300.
Yes.
And they haven't changed any of their usages. And so he, you know, my mother-in-law has gotten on the phone with Consumers Energy and was arguing with them trying to get the analog meter back. And they said, well, we can't do that anymore because we've disposed of all those meters. We don't have them anymore. Well, I think I distinctly remember them telling me the reason why they were charging me money on my bill, aside from the fact that they have to send somebody to my house to read the meter, which they've always done, by the way, but now suddenly I have to pay their business expenses. But they're also charging money because they have to maintain, they claim, a stockpile of analog meters in case mine decides to die. Now, people have had these meters on their houses for decades, and they never die.
Right.
So I don't really see, but I mean, the point is that they told me they were maintaining a supply of them, and they told her that they had gotten rid of all of them. So which is it?
Well, when I was fighting the smart meter here, everything the power company said was a lie. Absolutely everything.
Yeah.
With impunity, they lied.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the whole smart meter thing, you know what the idea behind that is, besides being able to measure the input? Theoretically, it would allow people to have a choice of electrical providers. which is just stupid.
Yeah, well, that's not going to happen.
These utilities
would fight that to the death.
Oh, no, no, no. The utility companies have spinoff companies that can be the third-party providers. That was something
so it's
that
like
I...
like all roads lead to Rome. It's just pretty much the same company.
Right. The whole idea behind the Public Utilities Holding Company Act of 1935 was because of all of the shenanigans that electric providers were doing with holding companies, you know, to gain a monopoly status. Well, when they repealed the PUCA, it was called PUCA of 1935, it basically legalized it for utility companies to go back into the holding company business. And so they can spin off, and I believe what they're using is something called a master limited partnership, where they can have a corporation where there is a nominal ownership, meaning, you know, like a entrepreneur face, but the beneficial ownership are other shareholders. And that's exactly what Enron was doing. There was a Andy Fastow. Remember, he spun off corporations, and his wife was head of one of them. But they were Enron corporations, but the CEO actually, you know, somebody else, you know, and in that case, it was Andy Fastow's wife.
The CEO was somebody else. Is that what you said?
Yeah.
Skype,
yeah.
Skype, gotcha.
Where you have a nominal ownership. The person who is the CEO, what appears to be the owner of the company, is not really the owner of the company. Mm-hmm. They are just the manager of the company.
What a mess.
Yeah, yeah. The whole our whole electric system has become just the means of massive, massive corruption. Especially with this renewable energy, because I believe they've mandated that our government agencies buy renewable energy if it's available.
Mm-hmm.
Well, once transmission line, you can't tell whether it was produced through renewable energy or whether it's produced by a coal-fired power plant.
Right.
And so there are these third-party companies that were set up supposedly to measure and to keep track of the inflow of renewable electricity. And those third parties would then report, you know, how many kilowatt hours or megawatt hours of electricity were generated with renewable energy. Well, there's no audit capability on that. There's no way to audit that. So basically, they gave these third-party companies the ability to print money.
Yeah. Well, and then let's take a look at, you know, talking about hurricane or talking about renewable energy, you know, this whole idea of pushing, getting rid of the internal combustion engine and pushing you know, electric cars and this sort of thing in the hurricane region, what good would it do the people down in, let's say, Houston or people down in Florida if much of the state is underwater and you got your electric knocked out? What good is your electric car going to do you then, getting you out of the area? You know, that's one thing that's nice about the internal combustion engine is the fact that you can take fuel with you, and you can, and the distance is much, much further than an electric car can provide. So
that's a great point, Darren. I hadn't thought about that, but you're absolutely right.
Well, and there's another thing to consider too, and that is this push to get rid of cash. Again, without the infrastructure in place actually working, what good is it going to do you to have a credit card that you swipe when all the retailers don't have electricity? You know, how are you going to purchase anything if they eliminate cash? So in cases like that, you have no currency to be able to, I mean, and you could say, well, you could potentially trade, you could potentially barter, but if your stuff is underwater, who's going to want it? So
yeah, really, who's going to barter away something
waterlogged? Yeah, waterlogged. Yeah, and that's the other point. I mean, you need stuff. So I mean, these are things to consider. These ill-conceived ideas, which they sound great on the surface, but when you get down below, it falls apart in the practical world. Anyway, I just thought
I think about the whole technocratic tyranny falls apart if you examine it from a logical point of view.
True.
Cost-benefit analysis. I mean, do we really need all this technology on the highways? No, we don't.
No, of course not.
Do we need to sell off our infrastructure to pay for building roads and bridges? When I know that it's not the cost of the roads and bridges, it's the cost of the IT systems and the technology that they're putting on the highways. That's what's costing all the money.
Yeah, and I look for the price of beef to go up. Speaking of the hurricanes, I mean, there's a lot of things that are going to go up. Gasoline prices have already started to rise as these refineries have shut down. But we also have a number of people who have lost a significant amount of their cattle heads. And so this is a big problem as some of these cows, a lot of these cows evidently have drowned. The ranchers have rescued the ones that they could. But unfortunately, there's a lot of ranchers that are in trouble now because of this flood. And that's really a sad situation.
I always thought it was kind of odd to have cattle ranches in Florida anyway.
Well, I'm talking about in Texas.
Oh, in Texas. Okay.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, around Houston.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, some of them actually said that they came back to their property, which was still underwater, and saw some of their cattle with their heads above the water, but they were, you know, much of the cows' bodies were covered in water, and when they tried to herd them into, you know, other areas, they just literally collapsed from exhaustion.
So, did they have stockyards at Houston, or what's the deal there? Because
well,
cattle take a lot of space.
Yeah, in some cases they were trapped. They got the ones out that they could, but you know, the properties became flooded too fast, and they couldn't get the trucks in, and so some of them were actually stranded, the cows. So, you know, I'm sure they did what they could, but when you're dealing with a massive ranching operation, you do what you can. And so, anyway, prayers.
A ranching operation that close to a big city.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's just there's something wrong with that. I think.
Yeah. Well, I don't know. Maybe people can call in if they happen to be down there and have more information about it. I want to turn a corner though and talk about this DACA decision, because earlier I said if we have a theme for this show today, it should be betrayal. Now, we know that Trump signed a $15 billion Harvey relief effort and a debt ceiling package. This kicks the can just a few months down the road to December. But a part of that is how this whole thing came to be. He cut a deal with the Democrats to make this happen. And the problem, of course, is what did he give away? And there was a you know, the news media buzzed about it all, you know, earlier in the week, and this was a that he was actually ending the DACA program. Anyway, first of all, here's Trump at his press conference.
Well, I have a great heart for the folks we're talking about, a great love for them. And people think in terms of children, but they're really young adults. I have a love for these people, and hopefully now Congress will be able to help them and do it properly. And I can tell you, in speaking to members of Congress, they want to be able to do something and do it right. And really, we have no choice. We have to be able to do something. And I think it's going to work out very well. And long term, it's going to be the right solution.
Okay, so the media came out and said that he was ending the DACA program. Now, there's a couple of things you need to know about this. He didn't end anything. Actually, what he did is he threw a lifeline to the people who were on the DACA program, the so-called Dreamers. The program was likely to be shut down. Now, DACA, for those that don't know, is the it's the deferred action on child arrivals. Okay, now back at these are the people that illegal aliens, not immigrants, but illegal aliens brought their children into the country, and so they're here illegally, and many of these people are not children anymore. They're young adults now. So this idea, oh, we got to do something for the kids, it's all for the children. Well, they're not all children anymore. That's point number one. But these so-called Dreamers, this program was likely to be shut down by a federal judge. There was a similar sister program, and I forget the name of it now, but for the parents of these people. And that was, I understand, shut down by a judge. What Obama did is he set this program up by executive fiat when he couldn't get Congress to pass it into law. He made law himself, which you can't do. And he admitted at the time he couldn't do it. He knew it was unconstitutional, but he did it anyway. And so the federal judge shut down the one program and was about to shut down the other program when Trump intervened. And no, he didn't just shut it down. He threw a lifeline to them and basically made it to the point where it would be a more orderly shutdown rather than an abrupt shutdown. So he did them a favor, but you wouldn't know that from the media.
President Obama, who enacted the original policy, called President Trump.
Now, Vicky, here's the thing. Ben Rhodes was Obama's national security advisor. He tweeted out a certain word to describe what Trump did here. See, you know, after that, Obama picked it up and used that word too. See if you can determine from this montage of media coverage on this subject what the word was.
President Obama, who enacted the original policy, called President Trump's decision cruel.
President Obama's right. It's cruel.
We are talking here about a cruelty of quite a magnitude.
Look, at the end of the day, this may go down as the most cowardly and cruel move ever by a president in the modern United States, and we're just going to go and cruelly just take them away from this life.
To end the DACA program is one of the most cruel and ugly decisions ever made in the modern history of this country by a president.
Today's actions by the president and Jeff Sessions is nothing short than cruel as well as compassionless.
So you have a president needlessly tormenting hundreds of thousands of hardworking Americans with a cruel and capricious policy.
Joe Biden has just tweeted, brought by parents, these children had no choice in coming here. Now they'll be sent to countries they've never known. Cruel, not America.
All the statement reads, it's wrong because it's cruel to send these young people to places many of them have never lived and do not know.
Only in a cruel nation do you take 800,000 documented people and make them undocumented.
The bejeebers out of all these kids. In other words, there's a cruelty there.
And it's a signal to say, I can do something that a lot of people think is cruel.
This is one of the most cruel acts we've seen in the presidency in a long time.
This was a cruel, inhumane, and unnecessary move.
Trump administration's latest immigration policy move
It's been called cruel.
It's a very cruel and unfortunate decision to end the program.
As kids, his critics say the decision was cruel.
The decision by the Trump administration is cruel.
This amounts to like cruel and unusual punishment to like innocent children.
Immigration advocates say the move to cut them off is cruel. But
a cruel decision, cold-hearted.
As an undocumented immigrant and a DACA beneficiary, the announcement today was cruel.
Are you getting a theme here? Don't tell me.
I'm not getting it, Darren. You're going to have to tell me.
Yeah, I was going to play the Jeopardy.
You know what? It makes me so angry because I was around in 1986 when they had that amnesty.
Yes. Thank you.
And anybody that's in this country illegally or should have been after 1986, they should have been immediately deported. That's it. End of story. And I don't care if people call me cold-hearted or not. These, quote, children that are not children, they ought to be deported with their parents.
Yes.
Because their parents broke the law to bring them here.
And you don't reward illegal activity. Because
right.
That public policy 101, I've said it before, that what you reward, you get more of. It's just common sense. If you allow a thief to steal something, you're going to have a lot more thieves. It's just the way it is. And these people are coming here. And I'm not saying the parents don't have good intentions for their children. I'm not saying that I even blame them for wanting to better themselves. Because, let's face it, many of their home countries have been turned into a hellhole. And much of it is because of globalization. But that being said, you can't allow the entire country to flood in, or the entire world to flood in, from every cesspool nation in the world without proper vetting and without proper assimilation conditions.
Well, all of it is basically to create the North American Union, the quote common market.
Well, it's about creating a world without borders. If we want to really get down to it.
Well, regional governing. A system that includes Canada, the United States, and Mexico. And so, you know, they've just been using this migration push from Mexico, which was essentially a third world country, not because Mexico didn't have money, but because of all the money was concentrated in the hands of a few. Mm-hmm. Mexico is a very fascist country. But they have lots of natural resources, lots of the people down there should not be poor and should not be uneducated. You know, they have lots of resources, but of that country were never used for the people.
No, and there's a lot of Mexico's got so many problems. You know, I've got videos of Vicente Fox talking about how he's going to run for president in the United States, tongue in cheek. You know, he's putting out videos trolling Trump. And bear in mind, I'm not defending Trump. As a matter of fact, I think what he's just did here with this DACA thing is an absolute stab in the back to his base.
It is. It is. And I wrote an article about that, you know, asking the question, is Trump a swamp creature slayer, yeah, or is he just another swamp creature? And I'm saying he's just another swamp creature.
That's what I think, too, because, look, here's the thing. This is not something. Now, some of the other stuff you could say, well, maybe he was being guided by people around him. This, there is evidence, strong evidence here, that he knows exactly everything about it, that this was pre-planned and well thought out, well calculated. This wasn't haphazard that what he did here.
No, not at all.
And
he'd already talked about the guest worker program, mm-hmm, and DACA will fit right in with the guest worker program. They'll get the ones that are in college, you'll get H-1B visas. Yeah. Oh, but there is something too that I want to go back to the fusion centers for just a second, because I realized that there is a correlation between the MS-13 and the development of these hubs, these transportation hubs. And it looks to me like what is being done is that the gangs arrive, the drugs arrive, lots and lots of illegals from Mexico arrive. And, of course, they overwhelm the police department. The police department then needs help, and so that's when they regionalize the police and get the money to build the police state systems. Because if you just have a regular little small town, you really don't need that kind of technology and surveillance of your citizens. No. You have to have some extraordinary reason. And the influx of illegals and MS-13 serves as justification for getting involved in building the surveillance systems.
Yeah, and we talked about the 1033 program last week, and how Trump had restored the 1033 program, and among the equipment that's being distributed through the 1033 program are bayonets. Bayonets are making their way into the hands of local, quote-unquote, law enforcement agencies.
Well, isn't that special?
Yeah.
I guess they're planning on maybe perhaps not having enough bullets.
Yeah, maybe so. I got audio from Rand Paul, which I didn't clip. Unfortunately, I didn't realize I was going to bring it up now. But he was asking an official about this. What purpose would a local law enforcement official have for a bayonet? Unbelievable. Anyway, Nancy Pelosi got up there and excoriated Trump as the first anti-immigrant president in 30 years.
As I turn over to our special guest here, and I'm so pleased that so many members of the House and Senate are here, let me just say this. President Trump is the first president in 30 years. And let's just go back to Reagan. We can go back further. President Reagan not only acted, he acted after Congress acted. And he said Congress didn't go far enough. So he and President, then to become President George Herbert Walker Bush, did the family fairness agenda to do more than Congress did. President Clinton followed suit. President George W. Bush was a great immigration president, and we know that President Obama is a great leader, especially concerned about our dreamers. So this is the first president in modern times, in the lives of these dreamers, who has been anti-immigration, rejecting the idea that immigration is the lifeblood of our country, the constant reinvigoration of America, and that every newcomer who comes to America with hopes, dreams, aspirations, and optimism and courage makes America more American.
Okay, now, Chuckie Schumer got up, and he was grandstanding. And again, folks, he didn't end the DACA program. The DACA program was going to end itself because it was unconstitutional. But you would, you know, what he did is throw a lifeline to these people, and nobody's talking about deporting anyone here, even though they should be. But look at all of the manipulation and mind control that's centered around this thing. This is what you call controlled opposition. Trump is the controlled opposition. They are building all this opposition up to him because they need somebody to, you know, basically it's pin the tail on the donkey. We got to pin something on an ass, you know, and Trump is the ass. He's the bad guy. He's the guy that everybody's got to blame. But in the meantime, the whole thing is orchestrated, it's engineered, and they're all working together.
I want to cut to the chase. The president's decision to end DACA was heartless and it was brainless. If this order stands, hundreds of thousands of families will be ripped apart. Tens of thousands of American businesses will lose hardworking employees. We're talking about folks who were brought here as children through no fault of their own. They may have known no other country but ours and have voluntarily registered themselves with the government in order to live, work, and give back to our great country. They represent no threat to the country. In fact, in so many ways, the Dreamers represent the best of our country. They want to get right by the law by serving in the military, going to our schools, working at...
You got something to say?
I can't say it on air.
Our companies, contributing to our society, paying their taxes. They risk and sometimes give their lives to protect others in this country, overseas as members of the armed forces, and here at home, like Alonzo Guillen, a DACA recipient who died just last week trying to save others from the unprecedented floodwaters in Texas. So make no mistake, Dreamers contribute greatly to our country, to our businesses, to our economy. A recent study by the Center for American Progress found that 91% of DACA recipients are employed, paying taxes, paying into Social Security.
And stealing jobs from American people that belong here.
The same study.
Go ahead.
No, I was going to say, right. And what are our American young people doing? You know, they're not working. They're being given these drugs. At a very high level, I realize that what's happening to our country, the EPA is preventing us from having access to our natural resources because they became the protectors of the wilderness and the conservators of wilderness. We have the infrastructure protection paradigm that is to protect the infrastructure. Our government has been repurposed to protect everything except the American people. Yeah. In fact, they have turned our government to be against the American people, which is why we have our patriots on trial in Nevada.
Yes. When you listen to them and all of the things that they say about the Dreamers, all of the things they say about these people on this DACA program, you think, man, they really have a lot of representation in government. And they're not even, quote-unquote, U.S. citizens.
Right. And where's the representation for the American people in the whole damn thing? Worried about these illegals. Their parents were illegal.
Mm-hmm.
They're illegal. Get them the hell out of here and put our American young people to work.
Yeah, well, that's not going to happen. He goes on.
The same study found that ending DACA would drain $433 billion from our national GDP over 10 years. And even the Libertarian Cato Institute estimated that ending DACA would cost employers nearly $2 billion over 2 years. It's no wonder that 500 business leaders of America are up in arms over the president's decision.
It's called slave labor.
Now, I'm glad that some Republicans in Congress have voiced their opposition to the president's decision, because we're going to need them to right the ship. Congress has an ability and obligation to act, which is why we today are calling on Speaker Ryan and Leader McConnell to immediately put the DREAM Act on the floor for a vote in the House and Senate. We're ready to pass it. I am confident that if put on the floor, it will garner overwhelming support from both sides of the aisle. But let us say this, and I think I speak for the leader as well. If a clean DREAM Act does not come to the floor in September, we're prepared to attach it to other items this fall until it passes.
Okay, so I made the prediction on this broadcast back several months ago that we were going to see an amnesty under this president. And I think we're getting closer and closer and closer to seeing that materialize. I've got Trump's release that he put forward regarding this program, which will be in the show notes. I was going to share a little of it, but in the interest of time, I won't do that. And there's really no point in doing that anyway, because at the White House press conference, Sarah Huckabee Sanders, the spokeshole, basically gave a good rundown of it anyway. And so I'll just share what she had to say about it.
This morning, faced with the very real possibility of a potential immediate shutdown of the entire DACA program by a federal court, President Trump took the responsible and constitutional step of announcing that the administration will be phasing out the program over the next 2 years. Today's September 5th deadline was set by the plaintiffs presenting the administration with two and only two real options to choose from: the likely sudden cancellation of the program by a judge, or an orderly wind down that preserves the rule of law and returns the question to the legislative branch where it belongs. The president chose the latter of the two options. The president made the best decision in light of the fact that the system set up by the Obama administration in clear violation of federal law. President Obama even admitted this himself when announcing the program, calling it a temporary stopgap measure and calling on Congress to act. DACA was initiated after Congress explicitly rejected the same proposal in legislative form. In other words, President Obama didn't just suspend federal law, but implemented a policy Congress had explicitly rejected. There's a misconception that DACA primarily serves as a shield from deportation. This is misleading. DACA.
Did you hear that? Listen very closely. I want to play that again.
Misleading. DACA grants work primarily serves as a shield from deportation. This is misleading. DACA grants work authorization to nearly 800,000 individuals who are not legally authorized to work. DACA recipients whose average age is in their 20s were not an enforcement priority before, and they certainly won't become a priority now. The priorities remain the same: criminals, security threats, and those who repeatedly violate our immigration laws.
They're not a priority before. They're not going to be a priority now.
Yeah, so they'll just let them stay in the country, and then they get married, and then they have children. They have American children.
Yeah.
We've lost our country.
Yeah.
That's it. This,
and we're talking
this is
about,
no longer.
We're talking about
that's why the American 800,000
people, yeah, nearly.
That's why the American people 000. Are the enemy, because we're sitting here saying, hey, you know, what happened to our country? And what people don't seem to understand is, you know, once they rip apart the fabric of the nation, the Constitution becomes toilet paper. It means nothing, absolutely nothing. So if they think that they're going to have rights and things in a North American Union, there is no framework, governing framework for the North American Union.
Yeah, I don't think these people, many of them, even care about rights. They come from countries where they're used to not having rights. So how much do they value? And this is the problem. They don't value our system. They don't understand our system. Yeah. And unless you make them go through the process where they will understand our system, then they'll never understand or value it. And that is exactly why I'm not against immigration per se. I do think it, in this day and age, with the current unemployment being what it is and everything, that you could make the case for having a moratorium on legal immigration at this point. But I don't, in principle, have a problem with immigration, as long as it's done through the proper channels in such a way that to get the people who are coming here to become real Americans, to assimilate.
Well, I don't think you can even talk about it in the context of a normal immigration flow.
No, you're
because
racist.
What we are talking about is treason. It is the dismantling of the framework of the American government. And all of these people, whether they're coming in, walking across the border as illegals, or whether they're being massively brought in as refugees, or whether they're being brought in on H-1B visas, however it is that they are being brought into the country, the purpose of it is to disintegrate the framework of what the what the United States was,
mm-hmm.
what America is.
Yeah, and what Sarah's saying here is that DACA is not a shield from deportation, but it was a dictatorial and illegitimate, I say illegal, decree from a former president that these nearly 800,000 people who are in the country illegally are authorized to work here. That's it. That you have work authorization by executive decree when they weren't authorized before. This is the program, ladies and gentlemen, that your buddy Trump stepped up to essentially rescue. You know, he's being attacked for basically saving 800,000 illegals.
I think that's all a facade. The whole left-right paradigm, You know,
playing for the same team.
They are all playing for the same team. I heard a Democratic congressman say one time, "I'll be for you or against you, whichever helps you more." And that's the kind of calculation that is being done.
Yeah.
The media has to come out against Trump to, you know, and what that does is that it solidifies support for Trump on the right, except for people like me that say, hey, you know, he betrayed us. That's it. I'm done with this guy.
They have to create opposition. They have to create opposition to their plan. That's what people don't understand. They got to have opposition that they create to the plan, because the best opposition is the opposition that you can control. If you can control the narrative, if you can control your own opposition, then you really don't have any real opposition. And they scream louder than everybody else. And people have to understand that. And Trump is controlled opposition. It's very clear. Now, she goes on and talks about, because these people are taking jobs. You know, I mentioned that before. Allowing them to stay here is rewarding illegal activity, that of their parents. And you just heard Sarah, the White House spokesperson, tell you that deporting them is not a priority and never has been a priority. Now, how does that jive with the base?
The main effect of today's announcement is that work permits and other government benefits are being gradually phased out. But rather than leave DACA recipients and the men and women of immigration enforcement in confusing limbo while the DACA program was challenged by states in the same court that struck down another of the previous administration's unlawful immigration orders earlier this year, President Obama is laying out a responsible 24-month phase-out. President Trump. No permits will be...
It doesn't really matter because you can't tell a dime's worth of difference.
...expiring for another 6 months, and permits will remain active for up to 2 full years. The president was elected partly on his promise to deliver meaningful immigration reform that puts the jobs, wages, and security of the American people first.
Okay, now hold on a second. I want to back that up again because what she just said there is very important, and I'll tell you why it's very important here in a moment. Comprehensive immigration reform.
Listen. People first. He is delivering on that promise every day.
Okay, hold on. Let me back it up a little bit more here, because I want to replay that section here where she's talking about immigration reform.
Phase out. President Trump. No permits will be expiring for another 6 months, and permits will remain active for up to 2 full years.
Okay, that's another thing I want to... Permits, work permits for these people will be valid for 2 years. 2 years.
Well, that was the period of time that they were supposed to be valid to begin with. Do you remember when they Congress, or I guess it was promoted by Numbers USA, the SAVE Act and the E-Verify system?
Well, she mentions that in here.
Okay.
I believe
well,
she does.
Yeah, well, what the E-Verify system was basically the same thing as what was happening over in Great Britain turned out to be just a registration system.
Yeah.
By the very fact of doing the verification, that was a registration de facto.
And you can say, well, it's going to be that we don't care about the illegals coming in being subject to E-Verify. Listen, folks, It's them today. It's all of us tomorrow. I mean, let's not kid ourselves here.
The president was elected partly on his promise to deliver meaningful immigration reform that puts the jobs, wages, and security of the American people first. He is delivering on that promise every day,
sure.
And he was put forward serious proposals to Congress that would responsibly end illegal immigration, prevent visa overstays, remove dangerous criminals, protect American jobs and wages, and create a merit-based system that grows our middle class. These are not just President Trump's priorities. They are the American people's priorities. For decades now, the American people, immigrant and U.S.-born, have asked Congress to establish a lawful immigration system that protects our country. They've asked for strong, secure borders. They've asked us to protect American security and American jobs. And they've asked us to have compassion, not only for those who are here illegally, but for unemployed American citizens, including millions of unemployed African American and Hispanic citizens who continue to suffer under a broken system. The president's DACA decision today brings us closer to a safer, fairer, and legal immigration system. Now that he has ended this unsustainable and unconstitutional program imposed by the previous administration, the president is calling on the men and women in Congress to fulfill their duty to the American people by truly reforming our immigration system for the good of all people.
Okay, so what she's calling for there on behalf of Trump is comprehensive immigration reform. Now, where else have we heard the call for comprehensive immigration reform?
Let's also remember that hundreds of thousands of talented, hardworking students in this country face another challenge, the fact that they aren't yet American citizens. Many were brought here as small children, are American through and through, mm-hmm. yet they live every day with the threat of deportation. Others came more recently to study business and science and engineering. But as soon as they get their degree, we send them home to invent new products and create new jobs somewhere else. That doesn't make sense. I believe as strongly as ever that we should take on illegal immigration. That's why my administration has put more boots on the border than ever before. That's why there are fewer illegal crossings than when I took office. The opponents of action are out of excuses. We should be working on comprehensive immigration reform right now. But if election year politics keeps Congress from acting on a comprehensive plan, let's at least agree to stop expelling responsible young people who want to staff our labs, start new businesses, defend this country. Send me a law that gives them the chance to earn their citizenship. I will sign it right away.
So there you go. I have just demonstrated, ladies and gentlemen, that there is not a dime's worth of difference between the policies of the Trump administration than that of the last administration in terms of this whole amnesty, DACA, illegal, you know, the whole thing, anything to the contrary is smoke and mirrors. Yeah, they've had less border crossings due to the rhetoric of the current administration, but on the ground, as far as actual laws, regulations, etc., there's really no difference as far as the main whole infrastructure of the plan, of the policy.
Right. And it was actually first introduced in the G.W. Bush administration. And they called it the guest worker program. And, it was so that they could have a system to manage guest workers coming into the country. Well, you can't manage guest workers unless you manage your domestic labor force.
Mm-hmm.
So really, that was what they're really talking about. Forget all the terms that they're using. What they're really talking about is a national labor management system.
Yeah, they want a national slave system is what they're really talking about.
Well, it is, because they'll be able to control the price of labor. You know, if some American skill is being paid more than they think that person should make, those people should make, They'll just bring in add supply to the labor force.
Dianne Feinstein was pinned down by Chuck Todd on the legality of DACA, and she finally had to admit that it was on shaky legal grounds.
Was DACA legal?
DACA was executive order. Legal is the law of passage of something. There are 10 attorneys general that are prepared to sue. I don't want to get into that. The point is DACA is here, and we've got 800,000 young people.
Well, your answer indicates, though, that it's on shaky legal ground.
It is. That's why we need to pass a law, and we should do it.
There you go. She admits, and Chris Cuomo of CNN was forced to admit the same thing.
No, Chris, the judge had set the deadline, not the litigants.
I know,
so,
but what
so
if
So you have to ask the judge for an extension, which they had already granted one.
Right,
so you'd have
they,
to ask for an additional extension,
sure, that happens
which
all
the judge
time.
May not have granted.
May not
and
have.
Then you would have this instant nationwide injunction issue, which, look, all of the guests that you've had on, I've watched yesterday as well, and you and Allison put these questions to them, which would you have picked between these two? And you'll notice that they didn't answer, and you'll notice Dianne Feinstein saying this was on shaky legal ground, constitutional scholars from the left saying they also thought that the court would give this nationwide injunction. So which option did they want? Did they want it to suddenly disappear nationwide, or did they want the orderly wind down? Because those were the choices.
Right, but then the question becomes, what happens after the orderly wind down? And that's where we seem to have a big question mark.
I don't think it is a question mark. The Department of Homeland Security has said exactly what will happen. Unfortunately, this was unconstitutional to begin with. So when it goes away, we will revert back to the system we had before DACA.
But that creates doubt about where those dreamers are going to be. I think that's probably what motivated the president to say that he'll revisit it. But we'll have to see what
that means. And the last administration created this situation. Unfortunately, the pen and the phone doesn't work, as we saw when they were reversed unanimously by the Supreme Court more than any other administration in history.
There's no question that it's been legally dubious from jump. Nobody's going to argue with that in a very compelling fashion, at least not this morning. But it's also about, well, what are you going to do for these people? This is a moral argument.
It's a moral argument, not a legal one, is what he said there. It's not our job to worry about the moral argument with what happens to these people. It's our job to protect our country from invasion. It's the federal government's job to protect the country from invasion. That's what we have going on right now.
Where is the concern for our American young
people.
Yeah,
our children.
You know, where they have that MS-13 gang in Suffolk County, the focus, of course, is on just, you know, that one teenage girl who was arrested. But there are American students at that school that are being terrorized by the whole gang inflow.
Yeah, you know, I've got a Justice Department document here, which I'll put in the show notes, where it's talking about the Bureau of Prisons having an operational process for maintaining data regarding foreign-born inmates in its custody. Listen to this. There are 45,493 foreign-born inmates currently in BOP custody, of which 3,939 are U.S. citizens. So, again, 45,493 foreign-born inmates. 3,939 of those 45,000 plus are U.S. citizens, either naturalized or derivative. Of the remaining 41,554 foreign-born inmates or aliens, approximately 22,541 or 54.2% are aliens for which final immigration orders have been issued for the removal. Approximately 13,886 or 33.4% are aliens who are under ICE investigation for possible removal. Approximately 5,101 or 12.3% are aliens still pending adjudication. In other words, ICE has charged these aliens as removal cases, but a final disposition has not yet been reached. Approximately 26% are aliens who have been granted relief on the basis of asylum claims. Anyway, there's an overwhelming number of people in the Bureau of Prisons who are foreign-born that should not be here.
Yeah, and it costs taxpayers a lot of money to keep them there.
Yeah. I got a final few clips here, which I'm not going to get to all of it, but here's Lindsey Graham And he appeared with Dick Durbin at a press conference, and he's all in with the agenda.
As to the president, I think he was right to terminate DACA. I believe from day one it was an unconstitutional overreach by President Obama. He had a dilemma on his hand. I understand why Dick wrote the letter. I've tried to do my part to find comprehensive immigration reform, not only for the DREAM Act kids, but also for their parents. But the main thing I've tried to do...
Okay, anyway, I don't have time to finish that, but you notice he pushed the comprehensive immigration reform, which, folks, I'm telling you, it's amnesty. And we're going to end up with an amnesty bill, which I believe and I predict that this Congress will pass and this president will sign. Unless people really raise a stink about it, and then you might have a chance of stopping it, but I doubt it.
Yeah.
I'm not trying to discourage anybody from being active, but it's obvious we don't have much representation in this day and age.
We don't have any. Everybody has representation, but the American people.
It's sad. Our country has been stolen from us, and it couldn't have happened were it not for traitors from within masquerading as our representatives and our partners.
That's exactly right.
Hate to end on a negative note, but that is the way it is, folks. And one thing we do here is do the best we can to give you the truth each and every week. I hope you'll tell folks about the broadcast. Thanks, Vicki, as always.
Thank you, Darren.
In the meantime, pray for this republic. We'll be watching the Armageddon move in throughout the day. And join us back here next week. Same time, same station. God bless you, folks. We'll talk to you then.